BBC
Radio 6
Music.
Available on BBC Sounds. Concerts and sessions from the BBC Archive.
This is something we've waited for a long time on the show.
It gives me great pleasure to welcome to the stage at Maida Vale.
That is just one of the greatest things I've ever seen, no kidding.
From Stevie Wonder. To Radiohead. The Six Music Live Hour. Available on BBC Sounds. Right now, this is a BBC Radio Six Music documentary.
Hello, I'm Matt Everett, and welcome to The First Time. This is the show on Six Music where we speak to some of the most influential and best-loved musicians around about the significant first musical moments that shaped their lives and shaped their careers. Although she'd never admit to liking the title, today's guest is an icon. There are very few songwriters and musicians who've stuck to their guns as resolutely and remained as, well, cool as she has. My guest on The First Time this week is Chrissy Hynde. Born in Ohio, a rock and roll obsessed Chrissy moved to London in 1973, immersing herself in the London music scene as punk broke, buddying up with some of the main movers and absorbing a fearless attitude that will remain with her in all of her work. That song you just heard was Kid by The Pretenders, the band she formed in 1978, helming them through a run of top 20 albums and classic singles and keeping the band flag flying despite the tragic drug-related deaths of guitarists James Honeyman Scott and bassist Pete Farndon. Here she talks about the music that influenced her from her very earliest days through to the worldwide success of The Pretenders, her collaborative work with people like Johnny Marr, and her decision to release her first ever album solely under her own name, this year's Stockholm. But I started by asking Chrissy, as I do with all my guests, when was she first aware of music?
I can remember sitting in the, well, being in the kitchen in Cuyahoga Falls, so I must have been three, and it was always the radio for me. It was a song called Love and Marriage, which must have come on the radio. And I think it was a Frank Sinatra song.
Yeah.
The reason I remember it is because the actual lyric goes, love and marriage goes together like a horse and carriage.
Love and marriage, they go together like a horse and carriage.
But as a 2 or 3 year old, I heard horse and carrot because I associated horse with... And I had this image of an enormous carrot whenever I heard that song. Years later, I realized I had the lyric wrong. And then I realized, but that's rock and roll, you know. You can make up your own words.
You can't disparage. Ask the local gentry. And they will say it's elementary.
Was music always an appealing thing to you? Did you always find this passion through music when you were little?
Yeah. I think there's certain things that you just bring into the world, you know, from birth, and you can't deny those things, you know, and people have different things they like. And for me, music was, it really was the life-changing thing. Music and animals, I also always had that thing. You know, I think animal rights people will always say that. Nurses, too. You know, next time you get a blood test, you ask the lady, is this what you always wanted to do? They usually say yes.
It's a compassionate thing, I guess, music.
Yeah, I don't know what it is. I think there's certain things that you just have a, like drawing or painting. Some people, I actually thought it would be painting, but then I got waylaid by rock and roll.
What was the first record you owned? Always a big moment. That was yours.
I can remember where I was standing when I saw the first Beatles record in this big discount house where my parents used to shop. I Want to Hold Your Hand. That might have been one of the first ones. But before that, I think I bought a song by Freddie Cannon called Palisades Park, sort of a fairground sounding thing, and the Orlon South Street. I think those might have been the first singles I actually bought.
Was that about the time you started to think, this is something I'd like to do myself? I would like to create.
Yeah, I wasn't like thinking this. About that back in 1910, but I was, it didn't really occur to me. I loved singing, but I would have never said that to anyone or mentioned it. But, you know, it's just playing cops and robbers through the backyards and singing songs on the radio. But I wasn't a show-offy kid. I wouldn't have sung in front of my parents' friends or anything.
Candy Stanton is someone that you've mentioned as being a kind of vocal inspiration.
Yeah, I've discovered her later. I was had come to Cleveland, and then I'd gone to Paris and then back to Cleveland to get in a band. And that's when one of the guys I was going to get in a band with gave me some albums. And that's who turned me on to Candy Stanton. And who was the woman that sang Precious, Precious? That was another one. Jackie Moore.
Right.
And a lot of R&B singers from that time.
Precious, 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 precious baby of mine. If you don't love me, I'm used to that. If you don't need me, baby, I can adjust to that.
What was it about her voice that appealed to you so much?
It's just the believability. That's the thing about anyone's voice, and you know, the distinctiveness of it. It's never so much the acrobatics. I guess it's more the sound of someone's voice and if you believe them or not.
What about the first album? That's another big thing as well, because that's more, you invest more in a whole.
Yeah, oh, that's a big one. Well, I think one of the first albums I had was Mitch Ryder and the Detroit Wheels, and that was, I think that was someone gave it to me for my birthday. That's a big one when you first own an album.
Yeah.
Although, you know, and people still, vinyl's very popular, so I guess people still get that experience. The first Beatles album, you know, that was my period. So.
Yeah. Is there a Beatles track we should play from that era?
I Want to Hold Your Hand.
It's a classic.
It's a classic, although I doubt anyone has the frame of reference now to know what it sounded like back then.
Question of context, just,
you,
yeah.
You can't know. You know, it might sound kind of benign now, and we hadn't really heard of the Everly Brothers. We met it all through the Beatles, like they had blues through America. But, you know, that's the way it works. And it didn't sound like the Beach Boys, but there were harmonies. It just was different. It was English. That's what was great. It was English. English was magic. It still is.
What about live music? Because, you know, we've talked about singles, but seeing a performance on stage.
Mitch Ryder and the Detroit Wheels at Chippewa Lake Park Amusement Park. I saw them in an afternoon show, and there was a punch-up on stage, which was riveting, and I'd never seen anything like it. The main thing was the guitar player. I'm always partial to guitar players, and I was mesmerized by him, Jimmy McCarty, and I'd never seen anything like that. That was real life-changing for me.
What was he like? What was the...
Just a great guitar player. And I remember, I must have been 14, and I remember thinking, wow, the guitar is actually plugged into him. He's not plugged into the guitar. I felt it was just such a... it really was, you know, a moment where time froze for me when I watched him. And of course, Mitch Ryder was... I mean, the whole band is one of my favorite all-time bands. So I begged my girlfriends to stay for the show that evening, you know, when the lights came down. And they had the same punch-up. And I realized it was staged, and that was like the coolest thing I'd ever seen. So I think that's when I started subconsciously knowing that I had to do something like that.
Oh, hey, I'm sick and tired of everybody just pushing us around. Yeah, treating us like we're nothing and always putting us down. So
the brakes, baby, and feeling like it's all a sin.
This is BBC Radio 6 Music.
Everyone remembers their first instrument.
Well, I first had a baritone ukulele, which I think my parents gave me as an Easter present. And then I had one friend and she had a guitar and then we started trying to play together. And my first guitar was called a Zimgar. And it was a great big hollow body nylon string, sort of a classical type thing. And I had real little hands. It was hard for me to get, it was a real big, thick neck.
High action.
Yeah, you know, but that's good to learn on because, you know, it makes your hands more strong. Then I had a K Electric, which was a black semi-cutaway sort of acoustic electric thing.
Did you have any sort of heroes, other sort of guitar heroes that you'd be, I want to play like them?
Well, okay. I mean, yeah, I wanted to play like all of them, but I never thought I could play like any of them. I learned a few chords and that was... And I couldn't jam with anyone or play with anyone because they were guys and I was too shy to play with guys. So I just kind of stayed by myself. I wasn't good enough to play along to records, which is how most people learn. Still can't. And I had a Mel Bay book of chords. So that's how I learned, by looking at the chord charts. But I found out early on that if you only knew a couple of chords, you could make your own melody up around it. So I kind of got sidetracked doing that. I mean, singing a melody. And I guess that's, you know, starting where the songwriting that made it easier to access the guitar. So as far as my guitar heroes, I loved at the time Johnny Winter, Mike Bloomfield, who played with the Paul Butterfield Blues Band, was a hero. There was John Hammond Jr., who was I liked a lot of those blues. I guess it was more white blues, really. That's the kind of stuff I heard when the radio stations went underground and they were FM stations and started playing around the time that stuff like the Velvet Underground and stuff like that was being played. So it was blues, but rather than a sort of heroin bass, it was getting a little psychedelicized. James Brown, all of his bands, probably at my number one. James Brown was my big, big hero. And then as far as other guitar players, of course, Jeff Beck, Jimmy Page, all the English players, Hendrix.
The classics.
God. Neil Young wasn't considered as much of a guitar player then because he was in the Buffalo Springfield and we heard his voice first. But he soon joined the ranks, of course, and there was Stephen Stills, great guitar player. All the guys in Moby Grape could play, and that was another one of the standout bands of the time.
There was a big James Brown moment. There was the James Brown song we should play.
Well, the great thing about James Brown, of course, is that he could write a whole song around one chord, and that's an inspiration for a rhythm guitar player. And I wanted to be a rhythm guitar player, not because I couldn't play very well, but because I actually like rhythm guitar. And to me, that's the basis. And even Jeff Beck said to me that he couldn't play the same thing throughout a whole song. You know, he'd have, I guess he meant he couldn't just stick to the one. You know, so there is a, not that I'm comparing myself to Jeff Beck, but I can do something he can't do, and that's just play one chord for 3 minutes. When You Touch Me, I Can't Stand Myself, that's a good one on one chord. The Big Payback, one of my favorites, with one of the most sinister sort of background choruses of all time and scary. and highly sampled. Everyone will recognize the sample that has been taken from that. Or if you go earlier into James Brown... I had an album called Lost in the Mood of Changes, and there was no singing on it. It was just, you know, he played organ, and it was him predominantly playing organ. So that's another one, Lost in the Mood of Changes, that had some great background vocals. But if you go back with James Brown, you can get a lot of his great vocals on something like Prisoner of Love. I'd say that would be the one to play. I mean, that's a really perfect love song, which, you know, and is in this current trend of slave wave films, you know, with a lot of reference to the slave trade. I mean, this is the song. I'm surprised it hasn't been picked up more.
That's the song we'll
From
play,
night to night, you'll find me too weak to break these chains that bind me. I need no shackles to remind me I'm just a prisoner. It's just like the perfect love song.
Just a prisoner. Don't let me be a prisoner. From what command I stand and wait now. From what the master of mine fade now. I can't escape, for it's too late now. Let me be a prisoner. What's the good of my caring if someone's sharing those arms, but not with me. Although she has another, and I can't have another, for
What were your first impressions of London when you moved in 1973?
I've always loved London, and my first impression was it was just paradise. And I've always felt like that. I'm in love with it. I always have been. Everything was in black and white, and it was very primitive, but in a way that really appealed to me. I mean, I like rough. You know, I had to put shillings in the meter to get hot water for a bath. I was living on a, you know, pretty basic level. Hand-to-mouth kind of thing from day to day. And I remember walking down the street with some guy, and he goes, oh, I'm going to get one of those. And we were looking at a shop window at night, and I couldn't figure out what he was pointing at, and he was pointing at a television, and I realized it was a color television because they didn't have color televisions here yet. And I thought that was, you know, quite... I was in love with the place, always have been.
Was it always, I'm going there with the intent to make music, to find the band?
No, not consciously. Mainly I wanted to leave the States, and I knew I wanted to see the world, and it just seemed like the obvious first stop because I spoke no other languages, and I was in love with all those English bands, and I was in love with horses when I was a kid, and I thought everyone over here rode horses, and, you know, I had no knowledge of England at all. I would have never been able to name one member of the royal family or anything. You know, I thought Chelsea was a city. I had no clue about England, but I knew I loved it.
Because the mythology around the kind of mid-70s London punk scene is now, it's sort of described...
It's bigger than the scene was.
This is it, yeah. So, I mean...
The punk scene lasted 6 months.
Is that it?
Yeah. But then, you know, they say that Carnaby Street, there was only 300 people on Carnaby Street at the time, you know, and that had a great mythology attached and still does. The punk scene, well, from the January 1st, 1977, let's say that's sort of when it started. The Roxy Club went for about 6 months. all my housemates worked in the bars. And it was a reggae club because when they asked Don to play, well, when John Cravine asked Don to be the disc jockey, Don had this, Don Lutz I'm talking about, of course, had you know, a really extensive record collection, but no one wanted to hear anything but reggae. So, you know, he just played reggae. So it really was a reggae club. And then when the Heartbreakers came over from New York, all the drugs switched straight into heroin. Before then, it was speed. That doesn't take long to kill a scene off.
Do you remember seeing The Clash for the first time?
I don't remember the first time I saw them because I was trying to get a band together with Mick, and then he went off with Paul, and then they met Joe straight away. And but I was on that White Riot tour for quite a few of the shows. I was on the bus with them, so I saw a lot of their shows.
You're listening to The First Time with me, Matt Everett, and that was The Clash's White Riot from 1977, a hugely important track to my guest this week, Chrissie Hynde.
This is Six Music.
Six Music.
BBC Radio Six Music.
Sometime one thing leads to another. I know was a time I wanted you for mine. Nobody knew. You arrived like a day, passed like a cloud. I made a wish, I said it out loud. Out loud in a crowd. Everybody heard. Was the talk of the town. Not my place to know what you feel. I'd like to know, but why should I? Who are you then? Who are you now? Well, common labor by night, by day highbrow. Back in my room, I wonder that I sit on the bed, look at the sky. Up in the sky. Talk of the town. Maybe tomorrow, maybe someday. Maybe tomorrow, maybe someday. You've changed,
you've changed
your place in this world.
You've changed,
you've changed your place in this world. Oh, but it's hard to live by the rules.
still never do. Deals and such never bothered you. You call the shots and they follow. I watch you steal from a distance and go back to my room. You'll never know. In this world.
I'm Matt Everett, and this is The First Time on Six Music, where we look at some of the key first moments in an artist's career. And my guest this week is, I'm proud to say, Chrissie Hynde. And that was Talk of the Town by The Pretenders, the band's first US hit from their second album, Pretenders 2, in 1980. The band actually formed in 1978, and I asked Chrissie about their very first gigs.
Well, we went to Paris and played. We didn't have a name yet, but Nick Lowe had referred to a sound in the studio as dinosaurs eating cars, so that's what we called ourselves for a while. And then we came back. The first London gig we did was at the Moonlight Club, which is on West End Lane there. And we might have done a couple of north before that. I can't remember exactly. I don't remember gigs very well unless something goes really wrong. Same with watching a gig. I can remember things, you know, where someone freaks out and leaves the stage or there's a fight or something. Those are the standout moments, the memorable things. When everything goes smoothly, there's not much to remember, really, is there?
The first single was Stop Your Sobbing. Why was that track chosen?
Because Nick liked it, and I was trying to get Jimmy Scott to join the band and leave his girlfriend and his job in Hereford. So, and I knew he loved Nick, so I thought, well, if Nick produces it, Jimmy will join us.
It was a political maneuvering.
Well, yeah, but, you know, it was all fair. It was all, you know, it was nothing unethical about it. And, in fact, Jimmy fell in love with our demos and wanted to join anyway, as it turned out. Because the songs I had that were the punk songs, like The Weight and other ones that were on our original demos, were a little too angry for Nick's taste, a little too angry for Jimmy's taste, too. But when he heard the cover of Stop Your Sobbing, he says, I want to get in on that Sandy Shaw song.
It is time for you to stop the sobbing. Yes, it's time.
In terms of that first record, I mean, you know, it's a number one record straight away. Can you remember people's reaction when it came out? Because it's a different sounding record to what was going on at the time.
Yeah, well, we had some musical excellence, not on my part, but, you know, certainly had Jimmy Scott and the band had something special musically. And we had Chris Thomas producing it.
Amazing producer.
We considered him the fifth pretender from that moment and really learned how to make records from him.
Did you enjoy success?
I didn't mind it, but that was never really the object. I mean, of course, you want a success and you want your records on the radio, but I never wanted to know chart positions or where we were. I've never read reviews or wanted to hear about that. What I really like is being with the band and playing with the band. And then the rest of it is just, you know, you just have to do that to get through it. And something that happened with me, which was really was to my benefit, was that it took me a long time to get my band together, and I had a lot of false starts. And the whole time, I always had jobs. I've always worked. I never knew what the Dole was or anything. So I had a lot to compare it to. Whatever I go through in the band, I always know that's better than waitressing or better than modeling in an art college or better than cleaning houses or hotels or better than building picture frames. So, you know, I always know that feels more right for me, and I'm always grateful for it. So I would never complain about aspects of it that aren't as much fun. And the other thing is, when you're starting to get success in the early days, I mean, hopefully this is not the way it is anymore, but, you know, there's a lot of drugs and a lot of other stuff going on. I mean, when I had my first number one single, the same week my flatmate died of an overdose. So, you know, there's always like the two sides of. So right when you're about to get happy about something, there's something else that you have to grieve over. So it kind of keeps you in the middle. And I think in the middle is always the good place to stay.
First number one, Brass in Pocket. The legend is that you didn't even want to release the track. Is that true?
Yeah, but I don't like to say that because it sounds negative. And then people think, well, yeah, maybe it wasn't very good. And I'm not trying to convince anyone.
If you write a song, you're allowed to have an opinion about it, I think.
Yeah, I just thought it didn't really know what it was.
What do you mean?
Well, it kind of sounded like it was supposed to be Motown, but it didn't quite make it. I don't know. You know, it took me a long time to get over being afraid to get on stage, and maybe about 200 shows before I got comfortable with it. And hearing my voice was always a real turnoff.
Really?
Yeah. So it was very, it was a hard adjustment to make, to get used to all that. So I could try to avoid it when I can. But, you know, when it's coming out of shop, you know, speakers and shops and stuff. I mean, I didn't really enjoy so much having, I'd rather have a number 11 or a number 12 than a number one any day.
Got brass in pocket, gunpowder, I'm gonna use it, intention, I'm feeling mental, gonna make you notice, got motion, restrained emotion, I've been diving, detailed leaning, no visa.
Gonna make it see.
When Jimmy and Pete passed away after that, you actually said that that was the thing that propelled you forward with the band, that kept you working under the Pretenders' name as a, almost as a sort of tribute to them. Is that a fair thing to
well,
say?
Well, yeah, I didn't see that coming. I mean, even that I would continue it because, you know, for 2 years we said if one of us wasn't in the band, this was me always trying not to be photographed apart from the band. Mm. If one of us wasn't there, it could no longer be the Pretenders, that it was really the four of us in it together. And then Pete had so many drug problems, the group decided to let him go. And then 2 days later, when Jimmy died, I mean, it was just me and Martin. And I was particularly thinking about Jimmy at that point. And for many years, I thought he wouldn't have wanted, you know, Jimmy only lived for the music. That was his only interest. And I thought if the whole thing died with him, if the music had died with him and there was no legacy to it, I just felt that that would have been the real shame of it. So I kind of felt I had to carry on and keep the music alive. It's all that was left.
It's kind of not necessarily your musical life, but it's an important part of you. When did you first become politically active? Obviously, your work with sort of Petra is something that people associate with you.
I don't think of it as being politically active. I don't think of it as politics. So I'm not quite sure. You mean because of animal rights?
Well, yeah, I mean, there's some musicians stand up to be counted on subjects, some don't, and you're one of the ones that does.
Well, some humans do and some don't. And, you know, true. I'm not sure that that's even the place of... I learned a long time ago that if someone doesn't ask you for advice, don't give it to them because they'll just hate you for it. You know, so wait to be asked. As far as the meat-eating thing, I can't wait. You know, none of us can wait because slaughterhouses and factory farms and, you know, the whole destruction of the demise of life on Earth, someone has to account for it. And we feel like we're the guardians and we have to step in and we just can't help ourselves. It's just the way it's going to be. So if you want to hurt an animal, you have to go through me. And that's the way it has to be.
Should lack, not reverting back to type. Never mind, you lost your nerve. Yeah, you had a go at sleeping in the van, but you couldn't let it go too far. Now you got a pension plan, and your name's on the insurance, and you can't drive another woman's car. A kind of glamour you can lend yourself. Charities and such, like a debutante from days gone by. Shaving with a tie isn't sacrificing much. You lucky guy, you can still get high. No, yes sir, no sir, Sunday will be there. You only have to please that lady. Think anything you like, but be careful what you say. For another warm night, another dry day. A kind of I'm not throwing the line.
So this record is a solo album, having worked under the Pretenders banner for so long. When did you first realise, now the time's come to do Just My Name above the door?
I realised that after I begged Björn Yttling and Jaki Olhan to leave Stockholm and do the band and let's go on tour, you guys, and they wouldn't leave. Because they live in Stockholm and they have other bands. So I had to come back to London with my tail between my legs and there was no one but me. That's when I realized it. I mean, it's actually more of a collaboration, this album, than anything I've ever done before. So, you know, I guess you could say it's ironic. Or let's just say it's advertising. You know, it's the name that I hadn't used yet.
Are you slightly nervous about putting up stuff just under your own name without the Pretenders?
Wouldn't say it's nerves. It just it kind of freaks me out. I don't like it. I never wanted that. I always said I would never do it.
Mm.
But now nobody cares, so why should I?
What do you mean nobody cares?
Well, who cares what, you know, if it's, I mean, if, like I said, it's more of a collaboration, but I look at most solo artists and a lot of it is very collaborative and it still has, so that's what I mean. Who cares? It doesn't really matter what it's called.
Yeah.
It matters what's in the grooves.
Talking about collaborations, you've got Neil Young on the record.
Amazing.
I mean, that's...
It's stellar.
How did you first meet him?
I guess when I toured with him. I can't remember the first... It's just shocking how I can't remember these... what should be the most significant moments of my life. Yeah, Neil, I've toured with him. And I met him over the years. And the thing about Neil is I would have never asked him to play on my album if it was a solo album. I wouldn't have dreamt of doing such a thing. Even if I know him, I mean, he's still, you know, you don't ask God to do a favor for you. We had this song that I kept referring to as the Neil Young song because it just sounded like a Neil Young song. I must have made about 20 visits back and forth from London to Stockholm to make this thing because these guys were always too busy for me. And after referring to this Neil Young song for about 6 months, I said, of course, I could always get Neil Young to play on it. And then I would sort of sneak a glance to see if there was a reaction. And the more I did that, the more I thought, actually, I could get Neil Young to play on it. All I have to do is call him. But I would have never thought about that for myself out of just sheer respect for Neil Young.
That must have been great, that moment when the amp gets cranked up.
Oh, my God.
And the jack goes in.
Everyone in the whole building was stunned, you know.
But a joy to work with.
Oh, well, I mean, he's Neil Young. I mean, he's just... Everyone fought over his plectrum when he worked. I got it, by the way.
What's the Neil Young song that we should play?
Needling the Damage Done.
I caught you knocking at my cellar.
Before this interview took place, I was obviously telling people that I was going to do it. And for so many people, they're just like, oh, man, she's just the hero of mine. She's just such an icon. I mean, are you comfortable with that kind of hero worship? Because it strikes me that you've never ever tried to court this idea of being a rock and roll
icon.
Well,
no one tells you that to your face, so I'm very comfortable with it because I don't have to think about it.
I'm telling you to your face. Okay. You're a rock and roll icon.
No, I'm not very comfortable right now. You know, I mean, it's better than not being an icon or a hero, isn't it?
This is true. So it's
as long as you don't have to do anything, then, you know.
Other people can say it. I'll just carry on doing what I'm doing.
That just happens if you stay in the game long enough. You know, eventually.
I think it's more than that, but...
Well...
And the final question we ask everybody is to pick the last song. It can be anything.
Any song?
It can be old, new, something you heard this morning, something from your record, something from someone
Return
you haven't
Return of
mentioned.
The Mac.
Why that track?
Because every time I hear him sing it, I really believe him, and I really think she lied to him. And whenever I hear that song, it makes me want to cry.
Then that's the song we'll finish on. Thank you so much for your time.
Broken hearts like yours, mine. This morning at 11,
Tom Ravenscroft.
At 8,
Radcliffe and McConie.
BBC Radio 6 Music.
Right now,
it's Hugh Stevens.